I have a question for you, brethren, as we move into this message on this Sabbath day for you, and that simply is this. How do you explain the unexplainable? And how do you make sense out of the senseless? That is not just something that occurred last week. That is something that will yet occur in the future, next week, next month, next year, next decade. Perhaps some of you are still trying to explain seemingly unexplainable events that have occurred in your life. And you've not come to term, to tune, or to finality of what it all means. How do you establish your core values of personal existence in the midst of life's steady and sure bombardments? When such times do come, and they will, you better know what truly composes the fabric of your being. A look back in history can provide answers for what lies ahead. And that's what we're going to do this afternoon, in that we're going to look back in history and learn from the lesson of one man, a man who was set before the nation to be a teacher. We're going to follow the principle that's found in Isaiah 30 and verse 21 that tells us to note our teachers and to recognize that there is a way and that we are indeed to follow in that way. As we do, allow me to state emphatically that I personally believe that God does raise up leaders to serve His purpose, not only in the body of Christ, not only in the church of God, but He also sets up kings and prime ministers and presidents so that His purpose might be served down here below. Join me, if you would, in the book of Daniel, Daniel 4. Come with me. Daniel was explaining the dream that Nebuchadnezzar had. And first of all, it was a dream that had to be explained. Later on, within this same set of scripture, Nebuchadnezzar actually echoes the sentiments of the revelation of God that was shared with Daniel. But over here in Daniel 4 and verse 25, this is a part of his explanation of Nebuchadnezzar's dream. Daniel 4 and verse 25. This is speaking of how they would drive off Nebuchadnezzar out of Babylon. They shall drive you from men, your dwelling shall be with the beast of the field, and they shall make you eat grass like oxen. And they shall wet you with the dew of heaven, and seven times shall pass over you until you know. Know what? That the Most High rules in the kingdom of men and gives to whomever He chooses. This thought is not only mentioned once, but again in verse 32. Join me if you would. Follow me along in your own Bible, please. Where again it says at the end of verse 32, until you know that the Most High rules in the kingdoms of men and gives it to whomever He chooses. We need to recognize, brethren, on this Sabbath afternoon that the big headlines, the great headlines, are not being produced on the cover of Time Magazine or Newsweek. They're not on the front page of the Los Angeles Times or the Washington Post or the New York Times. The great headlines, the big headlines, are made in heaven. Now in that, God raises up and plants and places whom He will at a given time in a nation and or a collection of nations to bring forth His sure promises. Now, He not always gives us, in a sense, the same person every time. At times, He may give us somebody like a general. At times, He might give us a leader with this personality or that personality. There are other times that He gives us the personality that is set forth in Proverbs. Come with me. Proverbs 17 and verse 17. In Proverbs 17:17, I know we've often used this verse as in the aspect of relationships. But a leader also has a relationship with the nation that he guides and leads. A friend loves at all times, and a brother is born for adversity. There are times, brethren, when God allows and designs men to be born many years before the adversity comes, plants that individual so that when the time comes, that individual will be ready to serve out God's purpose. That's what we're going to talk about today, such an individual, such a time, and such a purpose. 150 years ago, in the midst of an immense struggle known as the Civil War, God provided such a man. He provided one man who could reach deep and knew where to reach to inspire, to lift up a nation, a divided nation, that was exhausted by the trauma of war. And this man, for the moment, and he himself did not even recognize the moment as it passed as to how it would affect his fellow countrymen, but in one moment of time, for simply 2 minutes, he brought forth everything that he himself stood for. And he summarized within 2 minutes' time, 10 sentences, and 266 words, everything that his nation stood for. This message of hope is often considered by most writers, most historians, as the greatest speech that has ever been given in American history, following the greatest land battle that ever occurred in the Americas. The speech, the Gettysburg Address. The man, Abraham Lincoln. Today, with you, I want to focus on what I would like to call 2 minutes dedicated to eternity. 2 minutes that are not simply come and gone on a battlefield or a farm field or a plane in the bottom part of the state of Pennsylvania, but ultimately we're going to be talking about your 2 minutes, which enshrine all that you hold near and dear, so that you can be anchored, brethren, friends, loved ones, when you are bombarded by what will surely come, so that you will not be swept off your feet. And even if you're swept off your feet, at least your heart will be anchored, and you will be able to have a comeback. So let's go back 150 years ago. Let's ask ourselves, what were the great events that led up to this momentous speech on that cold November day in 1863? Just 4 months before this time was the Battle of Gettysburg. But before the Battle of Gettysburg, maybe you do not know the significance of the Battle of Gettysburg, but allow me to bring you into the play of history. What was occurring at that time? America had been divided for several years. The North was fighting the South, the Union against the Confederates. Now what had happened is that General Robert E. Lee felt that what he had to do was is that he had to take the war to the North. Not to engage the war for so long in the North, but if he could just go north, get over the Mason-Dixon above Maryland, and be able to take the war to the North and just win one battle, then the war would sour on this notion of union. Nobody likes to see body bags. Nobody likes to see losses. And maybe with just the right timing, and of course, all sides always think that God is on what? Their side, that the victory would be theirs and they could have their own country. What had occurred was that up to Gettysburg, there were tremendous movements of troops and regiments in that border area, Maryland and Virginia. And amazingly, what had happened was is that they had lost track of one another. They didn't know where one another was moving. Amazing. Whole regiments of thousands of men, they'd lost track of one another. But you know and I know that an army not only moves on its stomach, it also moves on what? Its feet. And what do the feet need in war? They need shoes, don't they? And it had been told and heard that there was a small, out-of-the-way little town that happened to have a warehouse full of shoes. And so a regiment under General Ewell of the Confederacy took off for Gettysburg. And lo and behold, what occurred? What occurred was that as they were coming, interestingly, the South, they were coming in from the North. The North was coming in from the South. And all of a sudden at Gettysburg, guess what? The two armies that had been apart and did not know one another's movements, all of a sudden came into contact with one another. All of a sudden were engaged in the battle, which would be a three-day battle. Three-day battle took off. Day one had begun. And you know what? Nobody knew it was day one at the time. You know, you don't always get to plan your trials, do you? You don't say, well, you know, about 3:30 this afternoon, I'm going to have a trial. Nobody does that. And they didn't know that this was coming about. They were just going to get shoes. And now it began. The word went out. Here was just small battalions. The word went out. We found the other side. And by the second day, it's amazing how news travels, all the forces in the area came together. And in 24 hours, 85,000 Union soldiers were faced off with 65,000 Confederate soldiers. Day two came, day two went. Both sides, both the North and the South, had experienced victories in that hill or that dale or in that valley. But then it was the third day that would seal the fate of one side or the other. On this day, the Southern leadership misread the intent of the North. Are you with me? They misunderstood. They began to think that perhaps because of what the North was doing, that they had run out or were running low on munitions. And so General Robert E. Lee elected for one group of his forces under General Pickett to go forth across the field and test what the Union had. These were basically men from old Virginia. They were basically Virginian battalions along with other troops of the Confederacy, but basically Virginians. And they felt that victory was just perhaps minutes away. The enemy had run out of munition. You know, it's sometimes like when men play sports, you know, the last guy that's left standing, he wins, right? We win. All we have to do is go across this field. And so there's this vast field, this farm field, and there are the Union positions elevated on the other side of this field. And across that field, 1/2 mile wide, marched 13,000 men behind their regimental flags. They're not running. They're not doing the rebel war you-hoop at that point, but they are moving, they are poised, they are active, they are engaged, they're going across quickly. And then all of a sudden, one of the great moments of American history occurred. The Union had not run out of ammunition. And all of a sudden, those muskets went off. And on that battlefield, in just a matter of moments, 6,500 Confederate soldiers were either killed or captured. Now, they made it to the ramparts of the Union side. They were able to cross over. But on that day, what would happen the rest of the Civil War was sealed. On that day, and through that three-day campaign and through that three-day crusade, one out of three men that engaged both for the Union and for the South were either killed or wounded. Devastating casualties. Yes, the North won, but at such a cost. And the South, well, it would never rise again. Allow me to share from Bruce Caton's book, American Heritage, Picture History of the Civil War. It captures that moment by describing as the Confederate infantrymen came on steadily and quietly, nearing the awful climax of the war's greatest battle, Union artillery fire shook their ranks with deadly accuracy, and then both sides exploded in a tremendous clash of musketry. Caton goes on to describe from an eyewitness account as to how the battle noise was strange and terrible, and a sound that came from thousands of human throats, like one vast, mournful roar. You're there. You hear it. Some of those men on both sides were your relatives. Now, 4 months later, Abraham Lincoln is to give voice to that mournful cry and roar that was heard in battle. How could he make sense out of the senseless? How could he give hope to those that were now hopeless? By responding to an invitation to come, and perhaps you've read it in your own history books, to make a few appropriate remarks. On that day, the Gettysburg battlefield was to be dedicated as a national cemetery. Before Abraham Lincoln would speak for his famous 2 minutes, there was another speaker. And that man's name was Edward Everett. Edward Everett was a retired politician, but one of the most gifted orators that the country had ever known. And he spoke for 2 hours. You thought just Mr. Weber could do that. Well, if you had this morning and this afternoon, we're almost there. He spoke for 2 hours honoring the fallen dead. Now comes the man from Illinois. What is the man from Illinois going to possibly say after 2 hours of comments? What could possibly be said that hadn't already been said? You know, it's the stuff of legend that Abraham Lincoln wrote the Gettysburg Address on the back of an envelope in a stagecoach on the way to the battlefield. Simply didn't happen. The 266 words were incredibly well crafted and organized in a theme that has been bespoken as almost spiritual in nature. What is of interest maybe to you is to recognize that only the term "under God" was put into the speech as he sat there on the platform, recognizing that when you're speaking before 6,000 people, you need all the help that you can get. So bring in God. He also borrowed it, shall we say, plagiarized it from a very famous speech by an abolitionist. I believe as a God-fearing man and a Bible-reading man that Lincoln, perhaps at one time or another, had gone across the verse found in Proverbs 29 and verse 18. Join me if you would there, please. Proverbs 29 and verse 18. It's very important for us to understand this. Why is your pastor on the Sabbath day talking about a leader? And why are we talking about condensing our thoughts as to what is important for us, brethren? Because you are now being trained and groomed to be leaders in the wonderful world tomorrow. And we've got some training ahead of us. In this world, we have some picket charges ahead of us. And there are people that are going to come to you sometime and ask you to make meaning of what is going on in your family or in your community or at your office or at your school. And can you give them hope? Can you tie it all together? Or do you go look for an envelope to scribble a few notes and hope that those are enough? Proverbs 29 verse 18 says, where there is no revelation, the people cast off restraint. But happy is he who keeps the law. I really like it how it's phrased in the authorized version, where there is no vision, the people perish. Now Lincoln had to create a vision, give sense, give meaning to the fallen and to the dead. Lincoln knew that his nation needed hope. Lincoln, things never changed. Nothing's changed over 150 years. Lincoln knew that people can go days and weeks without food. People can go days without water. People can even go minutes without air. But nobody can survive without hope. That's what we're here, brethren. We are the church of the hopeful. We have the message. We have the gospel. And you, when these bombardments of life come, must be able to bring it down systematically and understand it past, present, and future. And that's what Lincoln did. He did that by giving this address. It's interesting that where the man before him for 2 hours had spoken about honoring the dead, Lincoln in the Gettysburg Address took the speech out of the past tense as far as what had occurred, brought it into the present, and moved the audience into the future with what he said. William Safire, in his book, Lend Me Your Ear, which I highly recommend, which is a collection of all the great speeches in history, says that Lincoln, what he did was amazing. He suggests that Lincoln's famous intro of 87 years ago offers a biblical solemnity to what he was about to say. He is bringing God now into the desolation and the disaster that has occurred all around him. He goes on to suggest this, that it may best, this speech, the Gettysburg Address that you now have in your hands, may best be understood by focusing on the metaphor of birth, of death, and rebirth. Birth, death, and rebirth. And without mentioning Jesus Christ in the speech, there are tremendous overtones of Christ's triumph over death. Safire illustrates how four images of birth are embedded in its opening sentence. Do you have this in front of you now? Do you have the Gettysburg Address? Let's look at it. Four images of birth. 87 years ago, our fathers, notice, number one, brought forth. This is speaking about birth on this continent. A new nation conceived in liberty. Again, speaking of birth. To the proposition, and dedicated to the proposition that all men are, notice, created equally. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation or any nation so conceived and so dedicated can long endure. Now, I thought that they were there to just simply mourn the dead and dedicate a piece of ground to death. But what Lincoln does, I believe, under the inspiration of God, takes what seems to be dying and wraps it in the aura of newness, of birth, going back to that something was conceived 87 years ago, gives it context, gives it meaning. Now, why is it that some people can look at the same item and see two different things? Where one man sees death, another man sees birth. Let's continue the thought here. He goes on then, Safire speaking, he then focuses on how Lincoln touches on the images of death. Notice as we go along here, we have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting for those who gave their lives so that the nation might live. And it's altogether fitting and proper that we should do this. But in a larger sense, we cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground, the brave men living and dead. When people die, you have to mention that they've died. You can't ignore it. It has happened. But he touches us on the images of death and gives honor and valiance to these men. But now, the death is not for naught. The death is not the death of a sparrow or a bumblebee or a crow. But what he mentions here in the Gettysburg Address, notice it says that we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground. He takes that which is earthly, which is death, and gives it to God. It's now set apart. Life and death have got to have meaning, have got to have what? Have purpose. Sapphire finishes evaluating this metaphor of existence by moving beyond the nation's symbolic birth and death to focus on rebirth. Let's say this, to focus on resurrection. As Sapphire so eloquently defines, out of the scene of death, quote, this nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom. And then notice, shall not perish. In that sense, as much as Lincoln understood at that time, immortality. From the ashes, the phoenix rises. Lincoln does not leave America with simply a distant past of heroic forefathers, of pilgrims and minutemen. Neither does he leave the nation with the blood that was soaking on the fields of Gettysburg. Does he mention it? Yes, he does. Must it be mentioned? Absolutely. Just like in our life, there is life and there are beginnings. Then there are sorrows and there are disappointments. But you cannot leave your beginning alone, neither can you leave the middle alone. There must be some form of texture, of continuity, of symmetry, of moving things together, of understanding that going up a flight of stairs, one step assuredly leads to the next. Lincoln does not leave America in the past. He recognized the recipe for democracy started in 1776. But at that time, it was just a recipe. Never been done before. There had never been a republic with a small r, this large, this many people, this far stretched out. Oftentimes, historians will simply call it the Great Experiment. And these people didn't know where they were going. They knew what they wanted to do, but they didn't know if it was going to survive day by day. And there are things that were addressed at the beginning and not addressed at the beginning, such as slavery, because if they had addressed slavery in 1776, the nation could not have come together. In one sense, the American Revolution did not end in 1781. In one sense, you could say it ended in 1865. And of course, many a historian will say it continues to this day. Why was this man able to connect with his audience? Why was this man able to connect with a nation with manifest destiny? You see, Lincoln himself understood about the subject of rebirth. He understood what it meant to start over. For his entire life, into that moment, had always been starting over. Many of us just think of the man with the beard that's minted on our penny, but did you realize that at age 22 that this man failed in business again at age 22? He ran for the legislature and was defeated at age 23. Failed in business at age 24. He was elected to the legislature. Well, that was a good year. Age 25. But then at age 26, his sweetheart died. He had a nervous breakdown by age 27. He was defeated for speaker at age 29. Defeated for elector at age 31. Defeated for Congress. How's your life going so far compared to Lincoln's? Thought you had a bad day? At age 34, defeated for Congress. He was elected to Congress at age 37. Good year. Good year. Defeated for Congress, age 39. Defeated for the Senate, age 46. Defeated for vice, who wants to run for vice president? But he's defeated for vice president at age 46. Age 47, excuse me. Defeated for the Senate at age 49. Age 51, I like that year. It's a good year. I'm 51. He's elected president. For in the words of the book of Esther, for who knows, but for such a time as now, the kingdom has come. Why we as Americans look back on this man is because we see ourselves in him. While we are ennobled and while we are cast in the Republican sense with a small r of a Washington, it is this man of manger quality, humble beginnings, a log cabin in Kentucky that captures our feeling. We feel like we know him. We could sit with him. We could talk with him. For he's the common man. He's the quintessential American. Abraham Lincoln once said, you know, God must love the common man because he's made so many of them. But it is from common people and ordinary people that extraordinary feats follow as they yield themselves to a bigger and to a better picture, to a greater destiny than that which simply has been in the past or is even in their tragic present. And that's what I want to share with you, to help us look at context and how we bring it all together. Why was he able to rise above this Rolodex of failure? Let me share a couple of thoughts with you for a moment. You might want to write these down as a matter of fact. I think that he learned that the key to personal success, my friends, is simply this. It's not what life brings to you, but it's what you bring to life that counts. And beyond that, do not wait to find your values in a trial. But be assured, as God is above, and you have the big picture in front of you in the Bible, you better have your values going into trial and know what you are about. Beyond this powerful metaphor of life cycles, he uses one word that I would like to point out to you here if you have your sheet in front of you. It is his use of the one word, dedicate. He uses the phraseology from beginning to end 6 times in 2 minutes. And that one phrase, that one word, dedicate, gives a constant rhythm to all that Lincoln says in those 2 minutes, 10 sentences, and 266 words. And it is the word dedicate that then ties the birth, ties the death, and ties the resurrection together. It is the word dedicate that ties the past, the present, and the future all into one story. His story at that time and our story today. Dedicate, out of the American Heritage Dictionary, to give you a definition. Number one, to set apart for a deity or for a religious purpose. And he already did that by talking about the hallowed ground, the sacred ground. Number two, to set apart for some special purpose. And number three, of interest, to commit a particular course, to be committed, to a particular course of thought and action. And that is why the word dedicate is so important. It is a rhythm. It is like the, if you've ever been to a livery stable, it is like the hammer on the anvil again and again and again and again. To dedicate comes through the speech. No matter what comes in your life, the bombardments, the death of a child, the death of a mate, the death of a friend. In this world of terrorism, what might happen to America? You and I, friends, our dedication must hold fast. We must be able to put purpose and meaning to whatever event comes in our life, be it joy or be it sorrow. And this he does. The author, Sapphire, again comments about Lincoln, that Sapphire states that his whole thought is rooted in consecration. He makes the secular sacred by pledging it to God. The first three dedications that you have in front of you, the first three dedications spring from the theme of the Declaration of Independence's ideal that all men are created equal. Going back to the past. The fourth dedication is reserved to enshrine a portion of that field as a final resting place. The fifth and the sixth dedication moves beyond death to the future, to the unfinished work, and to the great task remaining before us. This unmistakable rhythm links the fallen dead with those that are living and hearing his message, so that from their martyrdom on that field, those that were in attendance, 6,000, could go forth after that 2 minutes and have increased devotion to the cause. How does that relate, brethren, with our Christian calling? Our cause as Christians, as disciples of Jesus Christ, as followers of the way, as it is mentioned in the book of Acts, can never change. Hebrews 13 and verse 7 says that Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and tomorrow. His rhythm never changes. And while encapsulated in this earthly tabernacle of flesh, in everything that he came into contact with, it is not what life brought to him, but what he brought to life, the message of our Heavenly Father, that never altered, that never changed, and he was true to his purpose. As he is, as he was, you and I are to be likewise dedicated. You know, after the speech was given, Lincoln was displeased with the presentation. Many in the media that listened scorned it, did not like it, went like this. Want to all have fun for a moment? You're listening. You ready? Like, let's do this. Let's all wake up here a second. Got your thumb ready? You know what the audience thought? You know the media? Let's all go like this for a second. Let's get into it. They did this. They were down on it. Didn't like it. And you know why there's never... Thank you, Tom. Got the email. Do you know why you've never seen a picture of Lincoln giving the Gettysburg Address? They didn't have time to set up the daguerreotypes. Nobody took a picture because the speech was over before it was done. But Edward Everett, the man that spoke before Lincoln, was the man that came up and said to the man from Illinois, the common man, "I should be glad if I could flatter myself that I came as near to the central idea of the occasion in 2 hours as you did in 2 minutes." Yes, friends, sometimes when we reach deep and reach right, and what we say, because it's what God has given us to say, and we'll say, "Well, you know, I don't think it moved anybody or did anything." But I want to share a thought with you. You parents with teenagers, you grandparents with grandchildren, you friends with friends, you children that are adults with parents that are not in the way now, never underestimate. Never, ever, ever underestimate what you might be able to share in 2 minutes that can change lives forever. Is it not quoted in the Book of Wisdom, Proverbs 25 and verse 11, where Solomon says that words can be like apples of gold laid out on trays of silver? As you've noticed, I'm sorry the sermon's gone more than 2 minutes. I'm not quite where Lincoln is yet. But do not underestimate, my friends, what you can do and how you can move and share people. Lincoln thought when he sat down that his speech was a failure. But 50 years later, it was not. You never know how long the words can ring. I'd like to share from Jeffrey C. Ward's comments, page 412, from the Civil War and Illustrated History. He picks up the pieces. Long after Lincoln was assassinated, he talks about the 50th anniversary of Gettysburg. In 1913, the federal government held a 50th anniversary reunion at Gettysburg. Thousands of old veterans came to be a part of what one man called a radiant fellowship of the fallen. The climax was a reenactment of Pickett's charge. Thousands of spectators gathered together to watch as the Union veterans took their positions up there on Cemetery Ridge and waited as their old adversaries emerged from the woods of Seminary Ridge and would once again make that famous advance. One Union veteran said, "We could not see rifles or bayonets. All we could see are canes and crutches now. We soon could distinguish the more agile ones, aiding those less able to maintain their place in the ranks. As they neared the northern line, they broke into one final defiant rebel yell. At the sound, after half a century of silence, a moan, a sigh, A gigantic gasp of unbelief rose from the Union men on Cemetery Ridge. It was then, said one observer, that the Yankees, unable to restrain themselves any longer, burst from behind the stone wall and flung themselves upon their former enemies. Not in mortal combat, but reunited in brotherly love and affection. 2 minutes, 10 sentences, 266 words, 50 years later. Oh, were there still wounds? Oh, yes. Were there still scars? Oh, yes. And war takes time to heal, but the wounds were healing. The greatest speech in American history, after the greatest land battle in all of the Americas of all time. As we begin to conclude, allow me to come to point. Why I've shared this with you on God's Holy Sabbath Day. The work of the church is to be equally dedicated to a bright tomorrow and the rebirth of humanity in the bonds of brotherly love and affection. There is a world out there, brethren, I'm scared where we are right now. It's pretty tense. There's going to be people that are going to be looking for meaning in the events that are going to be occurring in the weeks and the months and the years to come along. What can you tell them? What can you share with them? Are you just going to leave things dead and dour and dying and negative? Or can the Holy Spirit of God that is within us take the matters that are around us and as a Christian man and as a Christian woman, give other people who may not understand it all at once or understand at that moment, but take the past, take the present, share the future, bring it together in hope. Join me, if you would, over in Revelation 21. Revelation 21, and let's read what you and I as Christians are dedicated to. Revelation 21, verse 1. This is it, brethren. Our cause did not begin in 1776. Our cause began before the foundation of time. Our cause did not begin with men. It began with the one that became the Father and the one that we now know as the Son. This is what it's about. Now I saw a new heaven and a new earth, and for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away. Also, there was no more sea. Then I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride, adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice coming from heaven saying, behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he will dwell with them, and they shall be his people. God himself is going to be with them and be their God. And God is going to wipe away every tear from their eyes. And there shall be no more death, no more sorrow, no more crying. There'll be no more pain, for the former things have passed away. And then he who sits on the throne said, behold, I make all things new. And he said to me, write, for these words are true and faithful. I don't know if you were counting because you were probably following along as I was reading. Only one and one alone could better Lincoln at getting the message across. Lincoln was what? 2 minutes, 10 sentences, 266 words. Brethren, this is the message that we as Christians are to be dedicated to in 150 words, in 9 sentences. Tells it all. Says it all. Brings our past, brings our present, brings our future together.